Session number 12537, Herbert Broster, Reel 4.
Mr. Broster, Reel 4. You were telling me about Nanuki and the...
Yeah. As I said, it was a brigade group, a brigade area there. And primarily we were for advanced exercises which went on in the Northern Punti district from Isiola Artis Post right through to Eritrea. This is where we came in very strongly with 5th Battalion because it was the backup artillery. And this went on until even after BJ. There were a number of exercises up there even then. But probably 4 to 5 months after BJ, things noticeably slackened off from the military angle because people begin to go home on demob and everything else, you know. And they started then looking for volunteers for various jobs. And it was, I think people were saying, well, let's volunteer, it's something to do. Well, I recall the first one I volunteered for, and you were always told you should never volunteer, and they were looking for somebody to go on locust control. This sounded, you know, interesting. Well, basically, what it came boiled down to, 2 Dodge 3-ton trucks with ramps bolted on the sides, 2 mules in each 3-tonner, and some hand canisters that strapped on the back and a handle on the side, you see, and these sacks of, I don't know, some insecticide or whatever, and the idea was that you went out, found these swarms of locusts, and you can't fail to notice a swarm of locusts, they're like a thundercloud, and you sprayed them, you see. Well, when you think now, what a nonsense, because you wouldn't kill one in a million. So anyhow, I thought, oh, well, let's have a go. So they took us off. There was just one British NCO and 8 Africans and the mules and all the stuff, you see. And the idea of the Africans would strap these things on their backs when it came to it and pump away. So off we went, and they dropped us off at a map reference somewhere, oh, it must have been about 100 miles north of Archer's Post, which is a fair way up. And they gave us another map reference. They gave me, oh, I had a map there, see. And they gave me another map reference to meet them 7 days later, and they'd pick us up there. So off the 2 trucks went. One was a British sergeant on there and 2 African drivers. Off they went back to Nanuki. And so we started walking. You were armed with your map and a compass, you see, and there were no tracks. It was camel thorn bushes and sand and scrub, you know, temperature about 120 degrees. It's pretty hot once you get out there, because once you leave Isiola, you go down sort of an escarpment into a huge, great, arid bowl, and it's pretty bare down there. Anyhow, off we went, and keeping roughly to this line, you see, as near as you could, because the ground wasn't flat by any means. Anyway, we've been going 2 days, and suddenly one of the Africans started shouting excitedly, you know. I'd look, and I could see this cloud, you know, it wasn't that far away. And so we made for it, and sure enough, it was locusts. And when you see them on the ground, locusts are about as long as that, possibly a little longer, 3 to 4 inches long, you know, and they're sort of reddy white in colour, a bit like a boiled lobster to look at, an overgrown grasshopper. And they were everywhere. You can hear them, the buzzing of their wings, it is mainly. And there were millions of them on the ground, and probably twice as many in the air. So, of course, these Africans very excitedly started getting their containers on, and so I said, whoa! They hadn't even filled them. We had water containers there. So we filled them up and mixed the DDT or whatever it was with them. And there they were pumping away merrily, you see. And they used all this lot in about 20 minutes. And came back for a refill. And I refilled them again. And then I said, well, we went out spraying. And I thought, well, if they keep refilling them, we're not going to have any water to drink. And somebody had completely overlooked this point. Because there's very, very few rivers up there at all. I think I know of one north of Archer's Post, about 20 miles north, and it was only water about 4 inches deep, but it was pretty clear. You could drink it, you know. Well, if you like the risk of getting bilharzia here or something like that. But yes, it was drinkable with the tablets in. But this was 50 miles south of it, you know. And so I thought, well, that's it. So anyway, I made them stop, and they couldn't understand this. And so I told them in Swahili, no margie or water, and they began to understand then. So we packed it all up in the three tunners and we just ambled our way to this map reference. And we were there about 48 hours early and we just sat there. And believe me, when you've sat there for 7 days, or when we're 7 days on your own with eight Africans and nobody to speak English to, it's pretty soul-destroying, you know. And I didn't even have a radio, nothing.
How did these chaps pass the time when they weren't actually working?
Oh, well, they just sit around. They were all right. They were just content to lay on their backs on the ground, or they sit there cleaning their teeth, because they clean their teeth with a piece of wood from a bough of a bush or anything, you know. They sharpen the end and they don't use toothpaste or anything. They never do, and that's how they do. Or else they're doing each other's hair with a bare razor blade, you know. That's how they cut their hair, and of course it's frizzly in any case. But they keep their hair quite very short. They don't let it get long, and they've got a razor blade there, and they'll carve that away, you know. But they'll sit around just talking or sleeping. They're quite happy to do that. They don't worry at all. In fact, if you suddenly wake them up, if you say you shot a gazelle or something, you know, and that's great fun. They'll charge after that, and they bring it back and they skin it and they gut it, you know. I shot a couple of them while we're out there on that, and for fresh meat, you know. Of course, they share in that, and they love that because they're basic food. You know, there's only maize meal and ghee, you know, this ghee substitute, this fat oil, like, you know, that they cook it in, and they just. The ghee is just, well, like revolting porridge, if you like. They do it up in balls and squeeze it in their fingers and drop it in the ghee and then pop it in their mouth. And that was their rations daily, and they used to get one day a week a ration of meat.
I was going to ask you about the rationing.
Yeah,
because when you were rationing NCO, presumably you had to provide different rations for Europeans.
Yeah, you had a separate ration issue for Europeans. And for Europeans, it was, generally speaking, there was fresh meat most days, not every day, most days, when you're in camp, obviously, but it's a different story when you're out in the bush. And then you had vegetables, and you didn't get many green vegetables, but there were some. Potatoes were usually in pretty good supply, and eggs were always plentiful, and tin fruit. I used to always conserve tin fruit, because I found from experience that when chaps are going off on a safari or whatever, you know, they love tin fruit, because it's got plenty of vitamins in, you know, as well. And not that, it's the liquid in it, you know. So, because you had to work your rations out at so many ounces or parts of an ounce per man per day, well, you know, with the best will in the world, at the end of the day, when you worked out how many for that particular mess, you never got it exact. So I always went to the tin below. So I made half a tin, probably, or three quarters of a tin, out of each day's issue of that type of thing. And I used to keep that in reserve in the ration stores, so that when they did come along and draw their hard rations, as we used to call it, I always had spare tins for them, you know. And this was very well received, because I hadn't missed it, you see, in the camp. I always considered that was the essence of a good ration orderly. And it was a bit the same with their cigarette issues. They used to get 50 a week per man, and that was issued by me. That was okay. And how you did that, you did it on the impressed account from the regiment on a Friday. Now, as it happened, if anybody was being posted, it was always on a Friday. So you didn't, when you got the cigarettes, you sometimes were two or three men short. But you still indented for them, you see. So these, again, I used to conserve, but I used to turn them over so they didn't, you know, although they shouldn't get dry. They're in those sealed round tins, you know, the little cutter at the top. When it came to some special do in the messes, like Christmas or any special occasion, I used to go around and put a tin in front of each place on the table. You didn't make money. It wasn't graft. You didn't make money out of it at all. But it was just the way of doing it, you know. But so they were pretty well fed, the European was. I don't say there was anything elaborate, but the food was wholesome and it was quite good and plentiful. And, of course, they could augment that in the... After the war, we had a nappy in the Nuki, and they could augment that with meals in the evening if they wanted to. But the African, he had so many ounces of maize meal, or posho as we called it, maize meal per day, plus so much of this ghee substitute, which used to come in 5 gallon cans and you poured it into for each mess, you see. Because the African mess was much bigger than the European one, as you can imagine. There were probably, each battery had its own mess, and there were probably 250 in each mess. And so you issued it in bulk.
Ghee is clarified butter, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is really, although it's pretty revolting looking stuff. It looks almost like castor oil in colour. You know, pretty revolting, it really is. But if you could get fresh meat, and we used to be allowed to go out shooting unofficially because there were no game laws in those days, you know. And the African would always volunteer to come. You know, you get more than you needed, you know, because they used to love that, run wild after something. And we used to augment their rations for that, like we did the European at times as well, with eland or gazelle or something like that, impala or anything like that. And but the African, generally speaking, if he didn't get that, he would get, say, one issue of fresh meat a week and bully beef. Now, he didn't like that very much, especially certain tribes, because certain tribes were Muslims, you see, and they wanted to know if the meat had its throat slit, you see. And that was another problem. But we got over that, and somehow they were convinced that corned beef was okay. And they used to eat that, and they'd mince it all up with this maize meal, like a hash. But by and large, there was no such thing as sweet or anything for them. Occasionally, we used to get oranges come in, fresh oranges, but they weren't like an orange we'd see. They were more green than that, you know. And we'd also get stalks of bananas, because they grow locally, but they're much smaller than the banana we see in this country.
How then did the African get their vitamins?
Well, what you've got to bear in mind, that in his tribal reserve, he didn't eat very much. You know, they really did exist off the land. And anything that the army gave them was 10 times better than ever they had before. You see, they had this bit of fresh fruit, as I say. But this ghee and maize meal, that was their staple diet, it really was. But they didn't have a lot of other things. Occasionally, there was an extra ration of something or other, you know. Their meat, when they did get it, was fairly substantial. I'm not sure what it was now, but I had a feeling it was something like £2 a man. Well, you see, the good cook could make that last 2 or 3 days, because he could cook it and use it again. And I no doubt that's what they did do.
How was your cooking done then? Did you cook by the vehicle or did you...
Oh, when we were out on safari, yes, very much so, by the vehicle. We used to use a vegetable tin, probably containing, in terms of liquid, containing 1/2 gallon to 3/4 gallon, you know, that size. You pierce a load of holes in round the side, fill it with sand, and mix it up with petrol. And so that's just set fire to it. And you put your pan or your kettle or whatever on top of it. And that's how we used to cook. And there was never anything supplied officially to cook with, unless the whole unit were going, and they take these coppers. And that, again, was drip feed, mostly. So, you know, that's how it was done. But in the units, they had proper cook houses, although the fire oven, a bit like the old fireplace you used to have in the kitchens years ago in the range, you know, the kitchen range, that type of thing, only much bigger, and it was all wood burning. Because that was one of the jobs the fatigue parties used to have to do, was go out and get wood, and that wasn't easy. But in the Bashar, we were fairly lucky. There was a sisal plantation, you know, that's what they used to make rope from, at the back of us. It had been abandoned years ago, and it was still growing, but it goes to seed, and you've got these long rods of that thick round, grow 10 feet up possibly, and they used to go out and cut all them down and bring them back, and they were great firewood, they really were, you know. Because it wasn't until after I left there where the government invested a lot of money there and brought back sisal and what was the other thing, there was something, a pyrethium, was it? Yeah, pyrethium, wasn't it? And they tried to make a big thing of it in Kenya, but it didn't work even then. But sisal, there was big plantations of it around, and I don't know why. I suppose it wasn't economical. Time you got it 500 miles to the coast as well, you know, another problem. See? Big country.
You mentioned you went on some operations in Eritrea.
Yeah.
You said, Ethiopia and Somalia. What kind of operations are
those? Well, one I went on was a petrol convoy to Addis Ababa. And that was 19 days on the road. And believe me, it was a rough ride.
What was your job on that then?
Well, it was dry. Well, you just manned the truck and you drove, and because you had your Africans and Europeans on it, and you all took it in there, because all the object of the thing was to try and keep moving as much as possible. And we didn't drive in the dark, obviously, but because the trouble was that if you were in the front truck, you really were in kingpin position, because you had nothing in front of you. But every truck behind was covered in red dust. And if you try to drive in the dark, it was like going through a London Pea Super, you know. So you had to stop. But one of the hazards were, you had a lot of these shifter tribesmen who had Italian arms that they picked up from the campaign 4 or 5 years before, you know. And their greatest joy was firing these things. And if you were going along in a truck and suddenly, ping, a bullet would go through the canvas at the back. And bear in mind, you've got a dozen 44-gallon drums of petrol in the back. It used to be a bit funny, you know, and all you could do, well, we had machine guns, Bren guns and rifles on there, and you'd rattle them back at because normally they'd be on the rocks or in the hills at the side, and, you know, tracks invariably follow the side of the hills or whatever, and you'd try and kick their heads down. I don't recall anybody ever being hit by one, because the fire was so erratic. And I don't recall a truck being put out of action. The main thing that trucks were lost over, breakdowns, you see, because 19 days on this Mirum dirt road, it's corrugated because it hasn't rained, you know, and it really is, it's terrible. And there was even tyres would be cannibalised and the old ones slung up the back and lumps cut up and bolted onto the others in many cases. And you can imagine what that's like going along the road with a bolted piece of rubber over the other one. The Italians first started that when they were in Italian Somaliland and Eritrea. That was their trick. Their big trucks, you know, the big Italian trucks in the old days, they were, well, better than the German trucks even, massive things. And we still had some of them that we'd obviously captured in the early days. And but they used to bolt these lumps of rubber onto the tyre and away they'd go, because there were no tubes in them, you see.
Anything to keep the thing going.
Keep them going, yeah. But, that was the worst of it. But coming back was easy. You usually piled into an Avro Anson mail plane, which is a wooden frame plane stretched with canvas, and you sit on top of the mailbags and fly back down the river through Lake Victoria. And then cut across country, but you'd be flying at about 400 or 500 feet in every air pocket you put, boom, and you'd hit the roof and come back on the mailbags, you know. But it was only a couple of 3 hours as opposed to 19 days, you know. So,
did you have any serious encounters with shifter?
No, not, well, yes and no, but not openly. We opened fire on them on a number of occasions with 25-pounder anti-personnel, where they were massing. Because this used to happen, and the district commissioners would report through, you know, to, I suppose, command headquarters in Nairobi by radio or whatever they had, and then they would decide in conjunction with the Kenya government what action should be taken and whether they were a threat or anything. And on several occasions after the war ended, during the war, I think they were prepared to let them get on with it, and because, you know, they couldn't afford to go. But on several occasions, we went up generally on battery strength only, 8 guns, and even on a troop sometimes, 4 guns. And you go up there and you spray the area. You couldn't actually physically see them, but you spray the area with anti-personnel shells, and then sit tight for 48 hours, and then they'd send out a patrol and a couple of jeeps to see if they'd broken up, and invariably they had. They got the message.
So this was, did the artillery in that case go out on its own, or did you have infantry?
No, normally you would have infantry, but normally only usually on a platoon strength. There weren't very many, you know, it was just to go forward to have a look and see what it was and everything, and then they'd radio back. Because we didn't bother to use the OP post for that sort of thing, you see, because the infantry could do the job.
You were just firing on spec.
Yeah, that's right. They give them a map reference to fire. And normally, I think what used to happen, from what I can understand, they wouldn't actually give it a burst over top of them, but close by, so that
the
cut down the casualties.
And what about Somalis? Did you have any encounters with Somali bandits?
Yeah, the Somali is a different person altogether to the African. He's a wild man, you know, and he's a very proud man, actually. I suppose the nearest thing to him in Kenya is the Maasai, because they're a race on their own. But the Somali is a bit more rough and ready, I would say. He's a wilder man than the Maasai, because the Maasai is a very proud sort of person. But the Somali is almost untrainable. But although the Italians used them as levies, you know, long, long ago, and they seem to handle them all right. And I think, looking back on it, the Italians made quite a big success of their colonies down that side of Africa. Of course, they got Ustad aid just before the Second War. But we didn't have a lot to do with them. They weren't even amongst these shifters, you know. Yeah, okay. We didn't have a lot to do, and we saw many of them. I went up to, what's the name of the place now in Eritrea? Begins with an E.
Asmara.
No, that begins with an A. No, that was as inland. No, there's a coastal town. But I've been to Asmara. But anyway, I went up there. I went to Mogadishu once, that's right. And then I went on up to Berbera. Now, that is really a godforsaken hole. And it's all Somalis, you know, in that area, and Eritreans. And they didn't strike me as the sort of people you were afraid of. But they took apart, pilfering anything. It was just, I think I was upright. If it was left there, they took it. And that was really worried. But Berbera, I found that the only way you could get to that was by sea, in any sense. And even then, you had to be hauled ashore with a motorboat and a pontoon. No big boat, there's no piers, no jetties or anything. And when you looked to the beach, there's just a few galvanised buildings, or there was then, and these pontoons were pulled up onto the beach, and the supplies were put ashore there. Really was a barren place. The trouble is people don't realise how vast that corner of Africa is, from the Kenya frontier up to the Red Sea. It is really, when you go by boat up there, you realise it takes 4 days to get up to the Horn there from Mombasa.
And you mentioned that you saw some irregular units.
Yeah, well, we never really understood what they were, but they were certainly irregular units, and they were Somalis. And somebody said they were what was called the Somali Scouts. Now, they had European NCOs or whatever they were in charge of them, but their uniform, quite frankly, was such a ragbag that it was a bit like what we would call the mercenaries today, I think. And whether they'd been recruited by the Somali or Eritrean governments, I'd like to run to control the army, bearing in mind the Italians had all gone. I don't know, and I suspect that's what it was. But they were pretty arrogant, and when we did come across them, if we were on a patrol, they didn't really want to know you at all. In fact, they'd stop if you produced a bottle of scotch or something, you know, but as soon as they were gone, they were gone. They didn't interfere with you, but they gave you the impression you weren't wanted.
How did you get on with the 5th KAR?
Oh, quite well, because, as you say, there wasn't a lot of mixing because they were only British officers, nothing else, you see. And it was mainly mixing from the point of view, from a social side, the officers' mess of the artillery regiments and the officers' mess of the King's African Rifles. But having said that, if you did meet them on the road, and what I will say, that KAR officer always was walking in front of those KAR troops. He didn't ride in a truck or anything. He was walking in front, and one of them was just beating the drum for keeping them in step, you know, because that's how they do it. There's always a drum, you know. And he always walked or went where they went. He lived with them. I had a lot of admiration for those people, because when you consider when they went out into Burma, and they went up the Kabul Valley, because that was the first advance in Burma after the big retreat, it was the 11th East African Division that was used. And nobody stopped to consider the casualty rate from disease, i.e. malaria, blackwater fever, and that sort of thing. They considered the African soldier could probably be immune from a lot of it, but they didn't stop to consider the British officers and NCOs that went, and the casualty list must have been phenomenal, because they went up in the monsoon area period to start the first advance.
Did they strike you as being generally efficient and smart when you saw them?
The
KAR.
The KAR, oh yeah, very, very smart. Very smart, yeah. There was even a band I've got a photograph of their band, actually. And they were dressed in red fezes, actually, the band, and a white uniform. Very smart. But yes, their officers were always immaculately turned out, during the day, bush hat, with a black plume on the side, with the 5th Battalion badge underneath it, and socks and shoes, and even a flash in his sock as well to match the one on the hat, because, you know, we all wore bush hats and with different flashes, but they used to have the feathered plume as well. Not a big one, but one like that. And they were always, yeah, very immaculate. You'd never hear of a KAR officer causing any problems in Kenya, in Nairobi or anything. I think the discipline from the top was far too strict. He had to set an example, and he had to lead by example, you see.
Did you find that the uniform and equipment you had in East Africa was comfortable?
The uniform you took from here, the khaki drill, was ridiculous. They used to give you shorts to go from here. They went down on these, then turned up with a turn-up like that, with a button each side. And the idea was that way back in the 1920s, 1930s, the British soldier abroad, he then put them down and put them inside of his putties at night to stop the mosquitoes. But of course, you didn't wear putties then, not in this war. You only wore these short gaiters, you see, and it didn't reach that far. So the first thing you did when you got to East Africa and you went into Nairobi, you bought a couple of pairs of decent length shorts, which they put on the notice boards as shorts indecent, because there used to be complaints from civilian customers of the Stanley Hotel in Nairobi and Tours Hotel, of soldiers sitting in these chairs, and they could see them from the other table underneath their legs apart, they could see right up between their legs because they had shorts on, very short shorts. But they weren't that short, but, you know, they were in comparison with military shorts. But the uniform, by and large, was, yeah, it was fine, because you didn't wear a lot. You either had khaki drill or Burma green, and your bush hat you had all the time. But after the war ended, they brought in what they call a number one rig. Now, this was a bit overdone, I think, really, for the artillery. And it never appeared before I left there, but it was due to. It was a white tunic, drill tunic, and white slacks, with a white shirt, and an artillery tie, and a very large red and blue lanyard with gold tassels that came round and hung on the button, you know, the sort of thing. And but you still wore your bush hat. They didn't expect you to wear a pea cap. And I think it was a bit over the top, really, you know. Although they were trying to promote a peacetime army then, you see. And bearing in mind that most of those people there weren't peacetime, they were conscripts still. But I came out of Group 57 and there was still quite a lot to go then.
Did you notice any change in the attitude of soldiers once the war had finished?
Yeah, because they... The attitude certainly did change, because most of them, as I said, were conscripts, you know, and all they really were only interested in getting home. They felt they were wasting their time, but they had to wait for their group numbers to come up. And the biggest problem that the authorities had was find them something to do. And this is why they produced these things like the locust control and everything, but I think that was a diabolical one. But they could have done a lot more by sending them off on, if you like, safaris.
Adventure training.
That's right. And this is what they couldn't see. Because, it would come under the auspices of military training out there, map reading and living off the land and all that type of thing. And that they could have done a lot more of that. And I think people would have jumped at it. Because, you'll pay a fortune today and go out there in the first safari, wouldn't you? And it's only a camera thing laid on, you know. It's there, always rounded up for you to see today. It's not quite like it was in those days. But yes, that was a great pity. But they did. People began to get lethargic and why aren't I going home? Why can't I finish my time at home and this sort of thing? Because they had to temper that with the amount of boats that were available, transport to get them home. They were flying people home even on planes, you know. They had a lot after the war, and they converted a lot of RAF Yorks to mail carriers for British Overseas Airways. Well, it wasn't British, what was it called then? British Empire Airways. And they were on the South African run. And they used to call it Nairobi. And any empty seat from a soldier from the transit camp, you would go home, was put on it. Some of them were afraid to fly mine, but...
Did you find that there was a deterioration in discipline and behaviour?
No, it wouldn't go that far to say that, no. It was just that people were a bit brained off. But no, they didn't get to the trouble of say where it caused trouble at all. Because, you know, especially when you were out of Nairobi, and there were the only two units in Nairobi area were central supply depots, the Army Service Corps, command headquarters, those sort of things. But, you know, we at Nanyuki, we were 120 miles north. And you could get out and about. There were one or two hotels out in the backwoods, you know, the 8-Span Hotel, I can recall, and the Blue Post Hotel at Theka, and the various places like that, you know. And you could get out to those probably weekends for a dinner or whatever, because it was fairly cheap living. And you could hire a truck then, after the war ended, from the unit for just a few East African shillings, you know. And you were allowed to take the truck without taking the African as well then. So, you know, and I think that was probably done for that reason, but they could have gone a lot further with it. And...